Well, let's go ahead and get started. We're a little bit late, but we do appreciate Ken and Dan being here. Thank you. You're our audience tonight, but we appreciate you guys coming tonight. First off, we'll introduce our RAC members, and so we'll introduce your name and tell us what you represent.
Active member.
Joel Batty, Agriculture.
Natasha Haddon, BLM.
Boyd Blackwell, Division of Wildlife.
Randy Durth, Sportsman.
Brett Previdel, Public at Large.
Dan Abeda, Forest Service.
And Becca Jones, Non-Consumptive Users.
All right, thank you. Talk about these comment cards. We've just already received one from Ken, but these comment cards are, if you want to comment on an action item, we want you to fill out one of these comment cards. There'll be a time for questions. That's any question you want to visit with or ask. That's the time for that. But when you get to the comment period, that's the time for comments. So please hold your comments until the comment period on the different items. But these are right out on the table, right out there. If you want to comment on any of the different items we're going to discuss tonight. First off, we need to talk about our agenda and vote on that. Has everybody had a chance to review the agenda? Mm-hmm. Any questions or concerns, additions? If not, I'll call for a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll make a motion that we approve the agenda as presented.
Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
Andrew made the motion and Natasha seconded that. All in favor? It's unanimous. Has everyone had a chance to review the minutes of our last meeting? Any additions or comments needed to those minutes? Changes, corrections? If not, we'll entertain a motion to approve that, the minutes from last meeting.
I'll make that motion to approve the minutes.
Brett Previdel made the motion.
Drafted.
Do I have a second?
I'll second the motion.
Becca second the motion. All in favor? And it is unanimous. Thank you. Okay. We're going to have Boyd Blackwell will give us our... We're jumping out of line. We're going to go to... Dan Abeda is going to give us a Wildlife Board meeting update from the last Wildlife Board.
Okay, yeah, you bet. So Director Fowkes gave a little update here on what's going on with the Division of Wildlife and throughout the state with wildlife. So the first thing he mentioned was just the impact from all the wildfire this summer. There's been like probably over 300,000 acres that have been burned, and they're trying to prioritize wildlife habitat improvement projects through the WRI initiative for rehab for that. And then also with the severe drought that we're in right now, they've been adjusting numbers for permits, and we saw some of that here this past week. There's also a new regional office in Springville. Central Regional Office is a new, brand new office in Springville, and there's also a new nature center. I'm not sure where that's at. Can somebody help me out with that?
The Springville office is the old one's being tore down, and they're just getting ready to lay foundations. And
great. Great. And then there's also a new assistant director in Salt Lake. His name's Ashley Green. So that's kind of an update there. Should I go into
the motions?
Just go ahead into the motions right now. Okay. So on the action item for the Fur Bear Rule Amendment, that was pretty much passed the way we kind of saw it here in the region. It did pass 4-2. There was an amendment to that motion, and that amendment passed as well. And the amendment is that as this moves forward with the Fur Bear Rural Amendment moves forward, that the DWR include the Animal Control Board there are changes in kind of like a 1-year review from the changes that are taking place right now. The fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations passed. There was also a motion for a to look at in 1 year from now a multi-year fur bearer license and report back to the board in a year from now. So there's that on that fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations. The cougar recommendations, there was a lot of discussion, just like what we had here in the region as well. And it was kind of really broken out into several motions, particularly here in this region here. The Book Cliffs did switch from a harvest objective to a split season, but the permits did maintain the same number, 29 permits for the Book Cliffs. It went to a split season, so, and that passed unanimously. Let's see. Also, along with that, too, there was a motion for a recommendation to include GPS data when harvesting mountain lions, and that would go into effect or be re-looked at in a year from now. So the, let's see, another one that passed unanimously was the Oker-Stansbury unit to split the Oker-Stansbury unit into two separate units. Stansbury will become a harvest objective unit with four permits. The Oker will become a limited entry unit with eight permits and include one conservation tag. Let's see, the next one was the Mineral Mountains area. This is a new area that was just received a kind of an introduction for bighorn sheep. So they created a harvest objective unit for mountain lion there with three permits for that unit, and those three permits came out of the Beaver East unit. So the Beaver East unit now has seven, and this Mineral Mountains unit now has three permits. And that's, again, to protect the new population of bighorn sheep on the Mineral Mountains down in Beaver County. Let's see. The Southeast Manti unit, there was a change there that passed 5-1 that they increased the Southeast Manti unit permits by only two rather than the division's recommendation of four. So from four was the division's recommendation down to two. They're also another one passed 4-2. This was the East Canyon unit, and that went to a limited entry unit and maintained the permit at 10. I think that the division was proposing a slight increase on the East Canyon unit there for mountain lion. And then the balance of the division's recommendations passed. Also passed 5-1 was the additional antlerless permits because of the drought, like I mentioned earlier, and those were, I think there were like 725 additional antlerless elk permits statewide, and then an additional 109 bison permits down in the Henry Mountains. And I think there was a slight kind of a modification there. I think they went on that. It was originally recommended as all cow hunts, but the amendment was for the last two, those bison hunts, to be hunter's choice. The sensitive species rule amendment, that passed unanimously as well. And then we kind of got into some expo permits and expo audits, stuff that we didn't really cover here in the region, but those passed unanimously as well. I think that probably pretty much covers it.
Okay. Thank you. Rich got a question.
Can you clarify that decision on the split season, how that impacts the non-residents versus residents, the big discussion we were having on the Book Cliffs?
And the Book Cliffs.
Lion. What exactly did that do in the middle of our – we had the big discussion about harvest objective and non-residents versus residents.
On the split season – the split season consists of harvest objective. No, it's not.
Limited entry.
Limited entry. So they have to put in for the permits, and so it will reduce the number, because it's not harvest objective, reduce the number of non-residents that can come and hunt. So it reduces that number, and you got to put in and draw a permit for that split.
So they split basically season. Approved what we chose not to support.
Yes.
Right.
That's correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments on the Wildlife Board meeting? Well, we'll jump in to ask Boyd, give our regional supervisor, to give us an update on what's going on here in the region.
Thank you. Boy, everybody's been real busy. Just real briefly, we've got a new Range Creek Bison Committee that is meeting. They met this week in Price. Clint Sampson is our representative from there because it involves the Bookcliffs Bison, and they're meeting to discuss the issues of bison that are crossing the Green River and going on to Range Creek. So they're the first meeting was more of a get together, set the boundaries and objectives, what they want to do. Let's see, we're also a meeting this week. We had a meeting with to discuss a Bookcliffs Cougar study that we've got coming to look at cougars, the effects of cougars on some of these units and the removal and movement. It'll all end up being part of our migratory initiative. We've got youth pheasant hunts coming up. That'll be on the 22nd. We've got the Kokanee salmon viewing. That's this weekend up at Sheep Creek. The guys, the wildlife biologists, are starting now on to put together their recommendations for their bucks and bulls once-in-a-lifetime hunts. If you've got some concerns, you've got some issues you want to talk to the biologists about, now's a good time to get that out there and visit with them. We are having some problems considering the year that we've had. Elk are lower. They're looking for food and green food. So they're getting into some issues along the boundary between the tribal and all the way from Tridale all the way down to Bluebell. So we're having to think out of the box. We have a pretty good model that we've worked on out in Oray in Joe's area that we're going to start looking at and maybe setting up some criteria that'll involve permits. We're just trying to think out of the box and trying to help our landowners out. They're being hit pretty hard right now. I don't believe it's a function of extra high populations. I think it's more of a function of conditions at the present time. Let's see, we're starting to prepare for our Pelican Lake treatment. Trent is working extra hard and with her staff. I'm serious. I honestly had something get stuck in my throat there. So Trina is working very hard with her staff to get Pelican Lake treatment set up. She's already got the rotenone here. It's stored, and they're starting to work on lining people out and getting equipment in. And it's going to go off the end of October still. Okay, let's shoot for the first part of October then. And so it's going to go off, and you guys are all invited to come out if you want to. Trina will find a place to put you, find something for you to do, and it's a great way to get involved. And and if they do like me, they'll find an easy job, and so you'll be okay. And we would love to have you come out and give us a hand. Let's see. If you have us on Facebook, if you're following us on Facebook, you'll see great footage of a salmon run. Mm. And it's really cool. So we would really invite you to come up and take a look at salmon at Sheep Creek. I wouldn't bother with strawberry. I'd just go straight up to Sheep Creek, and you owe me. Okay. So, okay. The last thing I want to talk to you about, and I've talked to you a little bit about it before, is our community fishing pond that our aquatic staff are working so hard on. And it's coming along. And I was given a basically a rendition of what it looks like. And of course, I don't know if you remember, it's called the Fort Thornburg Fishing Ponds. And basically, this is a rendition, and I'm going to pass it down. We'll pass it back up. But the bathrooms are in. The parking lot is in. It's coming along really, really well, and I believe it's on schedule, too, to open this spring, right? Yep. So I'm going to pass that down, just take a look at it, and we'll pass it back that way. I'm just naturally right-handed, so it went this direction. So I believe that's everything, Mr. Chairman, unless there's questions.
I got two questions. The stuff we're doing at Pelican Lake, is that basically to get rid of the parasite in the what is our reasoning? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why don't you come on up?
Yes, thank you. Please state your name.
Trina Hedrick. Is that good? So, yeah, no, that won't get rid of the parasite. That is a multi-host parasite, and so you'd have to get rid of snails and birds and fish. So it is to target and to eradicate the common carp. Unfortunately, they are one of the more common or the more tolerant species in the lake. Black bullheads would be the most tolerant. We don't expect to kill them. And then the carp, and then, of course, the largemouth and bluegill are not very tolerant to rotenone, so they'll get killed first, which if you've seen them lately, they're kind of skinny and sad in any way. So, but yeah, it's mainly to eradicate carp.
Okay, and so it won't get rid of the parasites.
No, it won't. Sorry.
If you just fry them up, forget that they're there. They taste just the same as
you can. You can pick them out too. You can see them. So.
Now, when I was a little boy, that's where we fished, and we've got monster bluegill and bass, and
yeah, well, we're hoping to get
it'll
be back.
Great. Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Second question is, tell me more about the youth hunt at on the 22nd. What's going on there? This is different than the one that we normally start in November, right?
Val, why don't you come on up?
I mean, typically we're releasing some pheasants through the SFW and...
Oh, that's different.
And that's different. Tell me what this is. State your name.
Sorry, Valerie Fiorelli.
You can tell she's shy.
Yes, I'm a little shy. I wasn't expecting to have to speak, but that's okay. So Youth Pheasant Hunt, it's happening on the 22nd at Pleasant Valley Hunting Club out there.
Is it free?
It is free. Indeed.
It's free to the youth. Free.
Yes,
okay.
We will have some shotguns and ammo out there for people who, you know, might not have that stuff. I've had lots of people call me already about signing their kids up and getting signed up, and we have some guides and dogs coming out to help out, so some dedicated hunters as well. What else would you like to know?
Sounds awesome. That's great, great activity.
All right,
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Valerie. Brett Previdel has been one of our greatest supporters of this through the years. When I was a biologist and manager, he never missed a year. He used to come out and he would take the kids out, and his dog would be looking dead by the end of the day.
Because it would make your dog look good when you planted the birds.
Yeah, he knows all about it, and we used to do it out there at Kevin Conway Wildlife Management Area, and we'd release birds out there. And yeoman effort from Brett. He was always there and really good with the kids, and it was a fun time.
Thanks for
that. Awesome. Thank you.
One question also when you get to me.
All right, Jack, you got a question.
Just in addition to Brett's thing, we've only known each other for a couple of years, but I know that he was also very instrumental in a lot of the plantings and different shrub stuff, the different habitat work when the Kevin Conway first got started. So he's been a great asset.
Pick on Brett Day.
Thank you. All right, now we're going to let Brett talk for a second.
Wow.
No rebuttal, though.
Thanks. I got a question, Boyd.
Huh?
If we've already made a private land tag that opens on August 1st and goes till January 31st, and there's 2,000 of them unsold, why do you have to do another elk hunt in the Tri-Del area when they can buy them right now and hunt today with a rifle?
You know, the
private lands?
Yeah, I know. See, the private lands, they could still, they are still some available.
There's 1,900 when
yeah,
I checked.
Yeah, and what they did was they also added to some of our draw permits is what they did. And those are good on the anywhere on the unit. The private lands are only good on the private land units. And so we needed to try and work with populations that are above that ring. And so, yep.
Any other comments or questions from the region? What's going on in the region? All right, thank you. Well, let's just jump right into our 2019-2020 fishing guidebook. We'll turn the time to Randy. I'm sorry, to Craig. Craig.
It's quite all right. Did I get to see my presentation?
Good evening. As was mentioned, my name is Craig Walker. I am the Assistant Chief of the Aquatic Section with the Division of Wildlife Resources over sport fish. Tonight I'd like to present to you the results of our 2018 fishing regulations survey and our suggested guidebook regulation changes for the 2019-2020 cycle. Before we get into the survey results and the suggested changes for our regs, I did want to go over with you some objectives of regulations in general when we put them forward. When we put forward regulations, we're trying to maximize angler satisfaction among our angling public, increase angler use of fisheries throughout Utah, enhance trophy opportunities where possible, modify harvest where desirable, oftentimes to simplify regulations when necessary and beneficial, and in some instances, maintain consistency between management actions and conservation needs. As I go through the suggested regulation changes for 2019-20, I'm actually going to try to tack back into these objectives as they relate to each one of those suggested regulation changes. Jumping right into our fishing regulation survey for 2018. In 2018, the Division of Wildlife Resources conducted an online survey to gather angler input on proposed regulation changes for the 19-20 cycle. The survey ran from May 18 through June 15 of 2018, and we received 4,718 responses to that survey. That's a 27% response rate. For those of you that have ever engaged in the survey business, that's actually a pretty good response rate. In addition to people's opinions on suggested regulation changes, we did collect information on angler behaviors, preferences, and their county of residence to allow us in some instances to dive a little deeper into where those individuals who preferred X, Y, or Z on a certain regulation lived or what they preferred from a fishing standpoint. I'd like to note that fewer than 30% of respondents opposed any of the proposed regulation changes, and it says all of there, and I want to clarify that. That's not as a package. This is for each individual suggested regulation change. Fewer than 30% of respondents opposed those suggested regulation changes. We did, however, see localized opposition that exceeded that 30% mark on a couple of proposed changes, and I'll present that to you during tonight's presentation. Getting into the general regulation changes, many of you probably remember that during our 2016 survey, anglers were asked if they would support the use of corn as bait. At that time, 70% of respondents supported the use of corn, and we piloted on eight lakes the use of corn legalized as bait during the 2017-2018 cycle. During that time frame, we also tracked littering violations to assess the impact of corn use on these eight waters. In the 2018 survey, anglers were asked if they witnessed any negative impacts at those eight pilot waters as a result of corn use legalization. Of the 1,636 anglers who had fished at one or more of those waters, only 3% stated that they witnessed negative impacts. We conferred with our law enforcement personnel statewide, and they indicated to us, with the data that they collected, that there were no changes in Division of Wildlife Resources littering violations at any Utah waters during the 2017-2018 timeframe. I've got Hubble. I don't know. Also, anecdotally, the Division of Wildlife Resources law enforcement personnel did not see any impact of corn use from a littering standpoint or a chumming standpoint at any of the eight waters where corn use was legalized during 17 and 18. Right now, we are recommending, therefore, that legalization of corn as bait begin in 2019 in an effort to simplify regulations. A second general regulation change that we are proposing for the 19 cycle and moving forward from that point on is the removal of the Lake Powell reciprocal fishing permit. During the 2018 survey, anglers were asked if they would support this elimination of the reciprocal permit for Arizona residents to be allowed to fish at the Utah portion of Lake Powell, making it ostensibly the same as Bear Lake. They were indeed supportive of that, and the Division of Wildlife Resources feels that removal of the reciprocal permit requirement will increase overall angler use at Lake Powell. We're therefore recommending that the Lake Powell reciprocal permit be eliminated starting in 2019. This general regulation change was not put forward in our survey. It is a change to our species permitted for use as bait rule. Division of Wildlife Resources enforcement of live fathead minnow sales as ornamental fish requires clarification of the fathead minnow definition under the bait rule. The Division of Wildlife Resources is recommending that all color variants, including rosy red minnows, of fathead minnows be identified as bait species to draw a balance between management actions and conservation needs. What does that mean? It means that our law enforcement personnel will be able to enforce the prohibition of fathead minnows being sold as ornamental fishes, which will mitigate their escapement because people release their display fish and ornamental fishes, which will mitigate escapement and therefore assist us in our conservation of native species. Another general regulation change that we are proposing was not put forward in the survey again. This is the current set line rule. Currently, the set line permit license requires those under the age of 12 to possess a valid fishing license or combination license. Oddly, we don't sell fishing licenses or combination licenses to those under the age of 12, so this doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. And in the interest of ease of use and clarification, the DWR recommends removing this set line rule requirement for those under the age of 12. I actually don't know how that got by the board for so many years, but we did a pretty extensive review this year. Moving into the special regulation changes portion of my presentation, first we have one suggested special regulation change that applies statewide. This has to do with the fact that we would like to begin introducing tiger muskie to our community fisheries to expose young anglers and anglers in general to our tiger muskie fishery. Tiger muskie are the only species that we have out there that I would consider to be a charismatic megafauna, equivalent to big game. In fact, in other states, muskie are actually categorized as big game. And we really feel that this is a good tool to be using at our community waters to encourage people to participate in the sport of fishing and stay with it for the long haul. However, we do recognize that tiger muskie can only be stocked into waters at low densities, and community waters are small. So there will be few of these tiger muskie in these community waters. We want to make sure that they persist. And under the current regulation, two fish, regardless of species, are allowed to be harvested. If tiger muskie are harvested at two fish per day, they are not going to persist very long in those community waters, and we will not achieve our objective of introducing anglers to tiger muskie fishing. So right now we are recommending the establishment of a catch and release regulation for tiger muskie at community fishing ponds. However, we will be maintaining a current two fish regulation for all other species at community waters. This will also entail the development of special regs for each community water where tiger muskie are introduced. Moving on to region-specific special regulation changes. In the Northeast region, we asked respondents if they would be supportive of a two-day possession limit at Flaming Gorge Reservoir and a liberalized lake trout limit. Some of you may remember all the way back to 2014 when we began the two-day possession movement. We established two-day possession limits at all but two waters throughout the state of Utah. That was Flaming Gorge and Strawberry Reservoir. At that time, we responded to the board and we stated that we would examine the future two-day possession limit establishment at the two remaining waters and make sure that during the interim period we would assess whether or not any establishment of two-day possession would be impactful to the Flaming Gorge fishery as well as the Strawberry fishery. So for the respondents that were asked this question, whether they would support a two-day possession and liberalized lake trout limit, only 17% of respondents statewide opposed a two-day possession. That would allow for 8 trout or kokanee salmon in possession, no more of which could be 6 kokanee salmon, 24 lake trout in possession with 2 exceeding 28 inches, 12 catfish, and 20 smallmouth bass and largemouth bass combined total, also known as black bass. Actually, among those respondents who fished at Flaming Gorge, only 20% opposed this regulation. A little bit more background information on this. Wyoming has indeed moved to a 24-fish lake trout possession limit at this time. We are trying to work in concert with them to have consistency among our regulations, and we've actually established a reciprocal agreement right now. We're waiting to finalize that. Moving forward, the language in the reciprocal agreement indicates that we will come to consensus with our Flaming Gorge regulations prior to presenting those regulations to our respective boards. And it is hoped that Wyoming will sign that agreement here in the next couple of weeks. We are both states are interested in encouraging the harvest of lake trout to mitigate the impact to kokanee salmon at Flaming Gorge Reservoir. Additionally, the Division of Wildlife Resources has observed no biological effect of two-day possession at other waters throughout the state during the four-year period when that two-day possession has been in place. And in an effort to simplify regulations and increase angler harvest of lake trout, the Division of Wildlife Resources is recommending a two-day possession at Flaming Gorge with a one-day limit of 12 lake trout with 1 over 28 inches. That means that the two-day possession for lake trout or trophy lake trout will be 2 over 28 inches. That does not necessarily jive with what Wyoming has in place. However, we feel that during the next round, as I mentioned, as we try to come to consensus, we are going to probably have to come to a common regulation between the two states on this. And we feel that we have enough evidence to convince Wyoming to move in that direction. And I mention that because we examined our 2013 creel survey data for Flaming Gorge, and these are just some fun facts to give you a feel for how little impact our trophy lake trout harvest with a two-day possession limit is going to have on the trophy lake trout population at Flaming Gorge. Based upon our summer creel, an average angler will catch a trophy lake trout once every 6 days. According to that summer creel also, an average angler will harvest a trophy lake trout once every 42 days. According to the winter creel, an average angler will catch a trophy lake trout once every 86 days, and an average angler would harvest a trophy lake trout once every 4,821 days. There's not a lot of trophy lake trout being harvested in general. People don't take them home. People are catch and release when it comes to these fish, so we're not too worried about making this jive with our other two-day possession limits statewide. Moving on to the central region, A similar situation, as I mentioned before, Strawberry is one of two waters that does not currently have a two-day possession limit. We asked anglers if they would be supportive of the establishment of a two-day possession at Strawberry. Only 13% of respondents opposed a two-day possession. That would include 8 trout or kokanee salmon in possession, no more of 4 of those fish being cutthroat trout under 15 inches, and no more of those cutthroat trout being, no more than 2 of those cutthroat trout being over 22 inches. Among the respondents who actually fished at Strawberry Reservoir, still only 17% opposed this regulation change. I conferred with our, we call them the Strawberry Boys. We have 2 individuals that work specifically at Strawberry Reservoir. And I asked them, do you believe that this is going to be impactful to the overall harvest of cutthroat trout at the reservoir? And their statement to me was, no, based upon the data that we have from our recent creel, that is not the case. In fact, we probably kill more cutthroat trout during our sampling than are going to be harvested via this two-day possession limit being installed at Strawberry. That the two-day possession limit at Strawberry Reservoir be implemented in an effort to simplify regulations and, again, establish two-day possession statewide. Moving on to the southeast region, Pete's Hole Reservoir, we asked anglers if they would be supportive of the removal of a tributary closure on Pete's Hole Reservoir. That seasonal protection was designed to protect cutthroat trout when Pete's Hole Reservoir tributaries were thought to be important to the conservation of Colorado River cutthroat trout in that area of the state. They are no longer seen as important in that effort. Therefore, this was supported by the anglers, and we are recommending the removal of the Pete's Hole tributary closure to increase use of this fishery. Another southeastern region recommended change is the liberalization of the northern pike limit and a establishment of a minimum size restriction at Recapture Reservoir. Anglers were supportive of this, and the Division of Wildlife Resources recommends that we establish a 20 northern pike limit with 1 over 36 inches at Recapture to increase the average size of the fish in the population and increase trophy opportunities at that water for the species. Heading into the northern region, we have some folks in the northern region that really would like to see us start managing catfish, channel catfish. Right now, Cutler Reservoir is a target of theirs where they like to fish for channel catfish, and we felt that it would be an opportunity for us to begin making inroads toward the establishment of a trophy channel catfish fishery there. We asked anglers if they would support a more conservative catfish regulation. Currently, it is the 8 fish regulation at Cutler Reservoir. We asked anglers if they would be supportive of a more restrictive regulation for channel catfish at Cutler, and they were indeed supportive of that. We are recommending, the establishment of a 4 fish channel catfish limit at Cutler and its tributaries. Again, as I mentioned, in an effort to establish a trophy channel catfish opportunity at that water. We are going to be monitoring the response of the population to this change in the event that it is supported by the Wildlife Board, and we will use those results to inform our channel catfish management team efforts and future channel catfish management actions statewide. Heading into the southern region, East Fork of Boulder Creek. Right now, we have not highlighted this in previous presentations, and I'd like to remind people here tonight why we actually pursue cutthroat trout restoration in the state. I think that conservation efforts for cutthroat trout were undertaken for us to be prepared in the event of petitions for federal listing, to be prepared to defend against that federal listed status for both Colorado River cutthroat trout and Bonneville cutthroat trout in the state of Utah. I think that in the event that either of those species of cutthroat trout were listed in the state of Utah, it would hamper the division's efforts to manage other sport species, specifically other trout species in the state. Additionally, it would hamper private citizens in their ability to utilize their own property and their own water in the state in the event that these become federally listed. So when we talk about our conservation efforts, it's critical to remember that we are trying to prevent those negative things from happening in the state. We do recognize that in the interest of cutthroat trout conservation in the long term, we have removed a ton of brook trout populations throughout Utah. And we recognize the fact that those are important brook trout populations for many anglers throughout the state. Moving forward, we would like to begin working with anglers, specifically SFW, Utah Anglers Coalition, Southern Utah Anglers, and others, to begin establishing populations or reestablishing populations of brook trout statewide safely. We have the ability to stock sterile brook trout in certain streams. I think that we can do that and actually provide people with the fisheries that they remember while at the same time continuing to conserve brook trout, which is what we're trying to do here on the East Fork of Boulder Creek. We asked anglers if they would be supportive of the establishment of a catch-and-kill brook trout regulation on East Fork of Boulder Creek in the interest of cutthroat trout conservation. Only 19% of respondents were opposed to the establishment of that catch and kill regulation statewide. However, locally within Garfield County, 78% of respondents were opposed to this regulation change. Recognize that disparity between the local interests and the statewide interests. We also recognize the need to balance our brook trout fishing opportunities with the conservation efforts. We're therefore right now recommending on Boulder Creek the establishment of a no-limit regulation for brook trout on the East Fork of Boulder Creek. It gives anglers an opportunity to catch as many, harvest as many brook trout as they would like, but they are not required to harvest brook trout as they would have been under a catch-and-kill regulation. We feel it's a good compromise and still helps us move toward our conservation goals specifically on this creek. Another special regulation change suggested for the southern region is the Navajo Lake minimum length limit. Seasonally, lake or splake are vulnerable to overharvest, especially larger splake, and this regulation was suggested to protect those splake from overharvest specifically. It was supported by the general public, and the division right now is recommending establishing a minimum length of one trout over 22 inches to prevent overharvest specifically of splake. Moving on to the East Fork of the Sevier River, trout limit and gear restrictions. Right now, anglers were supportive of the removal of the fly and lure restriction and the increase of the limit from two trout to four trout on the East Fork of the Sevier River. Among those respondents who actually fished the East Fork of the Sevier River, however, 51% were in opposition to this regulation change. We recognize, again, that there's a difference between existing users and prospective users and their opinions. However, we are recommending the elimination of the fly and lure restriction and increasing the trout limit to four fish on East Fork Sevier River at this time so that we can begin examining the use or, excuse me, instilling the use of our waters by all types of anglers rather than a select few. In the event that we do see conflicts arise between anglers at this water, we will revisit this regulation, assuming it is actually supported by the board. Another regulation change suggested in the southern region is the elimination of special regulations on Mammoth Creek. Right now, the area covered under these special regulations is no longer available for public access. The division is therefore recommending the elimination of special regulations on Mammoth Creek in the interest of simplifying regulations. One thing to mention on this as well. The Division of Wildlife Resources would still be, assuming this is supported, would still be enforcing trespass on this water body related to wildlife activities. And the landowner here would still have the ability to establish whatever regulation they would like to put on for those individuals that are granted permission to fish this area of Mammoth Creek. The only limitation they would have there would be that their regulations could be no more liberal than the statewide regulations for the species that are present here in Mammoth Creek. Again, the initial agreement was that special regulations would be installed at this water in exchange for public access. There's a disagreement right now as to whether or not there was enough enforcement at that water, and therefore the landowner suggested that it be posted as private. Once it was posted as private, we felt that there was no need to have special regulations there. Again, we would enforce trespass, but not special regulations within a parcel of land that was only afforded access to a select few. One other elimination of special regulations suggested in the southern region is the elimination of special regs on UM Creek, which was supported by the general public. Cutthroat trout conservation concerns there historically related to whirling disease and elsewhere throughout the state caused us to implement some restrictive regulations on those waters in an interest of protecting cutthroat trout populations that we felt were already potentially going to receive high mortality as a result of whirling disease. We have not seen the high mortality as a result of whirling disease here on UM Creek. We therefore are recommending that we eliminate the more restrictive special regs to simplify regulations statewide. Finally, in the southern region, we are recommending the elimination of the special reg at Red Creek or Paragona Reservoir. For those of you that don't know, this reservoir was impacted as a result of the Bryan Head fire and sedimentation that came down into the reservoir. It had been a very robust trout population in that reservoir, and we had an 8-trout limit there for years. That probably shouldn't be there any longer given situation with the Bryan Head fire, the impact to the trout population. In an effort to try and let them rebound, we're suggesting that we reduce that trout limit to 4 trout, which would, for all intents and purposes, remove any special regulation because it would be the statewide regulation on that reservoir. So, with that, that's all I have. I'd like to thank you for your time tonight. I do want to remind you all on the rack and in the audience that we really encourage you to share your ideas annually via our angler survey that takes place on June 15th. Be sure to share your ideas with regional managers like Trina. Do as we're doing tonight, which is share your ideas at RAC meetings. And if you don't have access to any of those avenues, do email your ideas to dwrcomment@utah.gov, or you can mail your ideas to us at the Salt Lake office, Sport Fisheries Program Coordinator, Division of Wildlife Resources, P.O. Box 146-01. Thank you again.
Thank you, Craig. I guess I've got one question on the Mammoth Creek there with the Ryan Hatch family having virtually 100% of the water are there. What's going on there? Are they just unhappy because there's been trash left behind from anglers, or what's going on there?
So historically, and this gets into, 25 years ago, a verbal agreement between Dale Hepworth and Mr. Hatch occurred. And during that discussion, public access was going to be afforded on their entire parcel in exchange for us establishing or ensuring that we would enforce a very special regulation. And when I say very special, it's a slot limit on a small stream, which is very odd. So I don't think we have one anywhere else in the state. Their viewpoint was that we were not effectively enforcing the special regulation on that stream. They didn't see us there visibly often enough. They therefore decided to set up no trespass, and then they started getting trespass. And then we began to respond to the trespass calls. But the enforcement of trespass, unless pushed to its fullest extent, doesn't really curtail it. It's just an ongoing kind of maintenance issue at the boundary. So that's what's been going on over the past few years. Our suggestion right now is, I talked to Ryan a little bit after the Southern Region RAC, to sit down, see if he can get an agreement with his family on affording public access again, and then let's look at doing this over but doing it in writing so that we have clear expectations and an understanding of what the roles and responsibilities of all the parties are. To expect our law enforcement individuals to, who are strapped with 2,000 square miles per CO to oversee, to regularly patrol a small parcel of ground and enforce a slot limit on a small creek is unreasonable in our assumption or in our assessment. However, from a trespass standpoint right now, we would really appreciate a communication from the Hatch family when there is trespass on that parcel, and we would respond to that. My suggestion in talking to the lieutenant down in the Southern region was to enforce trespass to the fullest extent. And after doing that a couple of times, that's going to curtail trespass on that property. That is not a brief synopsis. That's the details of what we've discussed this far. I didn't realize it was going to be such a controversial issue, really.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, Brother Rack?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've got a question. So, Craig, the East Fork Boulder Creek.
Yes.
Was that originally, you know, going back a few years, was that originally statement?
Yeah, so we've met locally with the city of Boulder and their residents to discuss the rotenone treatment there, which was at one time planned. And it was a public review process. We didn't anticipate the pushback that we got for various reasons, one of which is the fear that use of rotenone in a waterway near human habitation is going to somehow impact human health, specifically Parkinson's disease and other concerns. We backed off of the rotenone treatment after our meeting with Boulder. Boulder, however, asked us why we weren't pursuing alternate methods of removing the brook trout population mechanically from that water. Mechanical removal, of course, in one form is a more liberal regulation, catch and kill, or in this case, a very liberalized harvest. We feel that we're addressing Boulder's concerns in the long term. We're going to be hopefully negotiating with them again to look at a chemical treatment, whether that be the use of rotenone or whether that be, as was proposed recently at our Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, the use of ammonia or an alternate chemical that might be viewed more as a more safe option from a public health standpoint. We don't know, but right now the existing regulation we don't feel encourages the removal of brook trout, and we feel that that isn't necessarily how we want to have regulations installed on the landscape when we know we're trying to actually get rid of the population of brook trout there in the long term. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you.
Okay, I have a question, and bear with me. I'm new at this. So I went online and I read some fishing forums, and a lot of people had concerns about the new limit on Flaming Gorge with the trophy lake trout. And so I was just wondering how the survey was asked in the, like, the question on the survey, whether they liked the idea of being able to harvest more of the smaller fish, but there were definite concerns about harvesting more of those trophy fish.
Yeah, the survey, the way it was asked, clearly spelled out a 1-over or a 2-over, 28 inches, if I remember correctly. And the 1-over 28 was supported more than the 2-over 28 with a 2-day possession. However, the 2-over 28 was supported to a degree that we felt it was justified from a public opinion standpoint. The big issue for us is when we start to examine the numbers and trying to draw the wants and needs, a balance between the wants and needs of the public and what we're trying to achieve biologically. And I think that, and what we're trying to achieve in the way of simplification of recommendations. To have two-day possession, regardless of size or anything, it's strictly a two-day possession at every single water but one, and only one size of one species at one water from a simplification of regulation standpoint doesn't make a lot of sense to us. Like if that is one reason why we're pursuing the two-day possession for 2 over 28. The second reason is, as I mentioned before, the numbers that point to from a biological impact standpoint, which is the fear, right? Anglers are fearful that if we actually increase this regulation to 2 over 28 in a multiple-day situation, the two-day possession, that is going to impact the prevalence of trophy lake trout in that water. Based upon what we're seeing coming out of our creel surveys, which isn't anecdotal information, that's actual real creel data, it's not. You know, to look at winter angling and see that one fish is going to be harvested every 4,128 days, it's not going to be impactful to the population biologically. So there's that. And then from a kokanee management standpoint, if we actually look at number of eggs that can be removed from a system when a hen laker is removed versus the number of pup lake trout that are harvested, which is about 27,000 a year, with the removal of the 880 trophy lake trout that were harvested during our recent creel survey in 2013, we would have removed, including a 60% mortality factoring, we would have removed 1.6 million pup lake trout from the system. We harvested directly via angling 27,000. All of this from a biological standpoint, as well as trying to balance the needs of simplification and our angler needs, because we don't want it to be biologically impactful, therefore impacting our angler catch rates. We don't view it as something that is an issue right now. Is that?
Yeah.
I am the most long.
I'm a little confused because
there's a lot of data there.
But I'm confused because there's like you're arguing that there's not enough opportunity, so well that they're not catching as many lake trout, and so we don't have to be concerned about them harvesting too. Is that
They're not catching many. The likelihood of them encountering a lake trout as an average angler is pretty slim to begin with. Once they do, they're not harvesting them.
Okay.
So regardless of how many we allow them to harvest over a two-day time frame, they're still not going to harvest any. There's still not going to be many taken out of the system. Is that?
I get it.
Thank you. Other questions by the rack?
I guess I have another question too, Craig. I'm curious about the tiger muskellunge, and kind of it sounds like the state's trying to kind of grow that fishery. A little pond, a little community fishing pond like we have planned here and that's scheduled to open up here in the spring of 2019, is that a large enough pond to support some tiger muskie?
That's actually going to be our first effort. I mentioned, you know, introduction to tiger muskie, but not necessarily introduction to tiger muskie angling. Introduction to angling. I think that we do not have many. The adage has always been, well, kids just want to catch something. It doesn't matter. Well, I can tell you firsthand that if kids catch something really huge and really cool versus something like the size of a small bluegill that I grew up catching with bread, they're going to be much more excited. That first exposure to fishing, if it is a more exciting experience, our feeling is that they are going to engage in fishing regardless of species in the long term. That it's going to be more likely that they're going to engage in fishing. Does that make sense? So it isn't necessarily specific to tiger muskie. Although we would love for them to become tiger muskie anglers because, you know, we've got those opportunities throughout the state too.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think that they'd love to catch them, but I think they'd love to take it home and show friends, too, when they catch it. which
Yeah, we walk an interesting line. So we've got species that we're producing that are important for us as tools out in the landscape, tiger muskie being one as a biological control, and a trophy fish that we would like to see persist in waters because they need to persist in waters for them to grow to trophy size. They're sterile. They don't reproduce. They're costly for us to produce. It's important that people learn a conservation ethic and learn to release those species in what I view as a classroom, like a community water also. But we also have a situation where when we jump over to other species that are naturally reproducing and we could use some thinning in many instances, we have a hard time overcoming 40 years worth of conservation ethic where people want to do catch and release only. So we're kind of trying to walk both sides of that aisle. But for tiger muskie, we would love to see anglers learn catch and release methodologies at these community waters. I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah. I think it'd be awesome. Yep.
Yeah, they're going to want to take them home.
I can't take them.
Well, yeah.
Lesson, right?
I'm pretty sure if I was about 8 years old and I caught one, they would have got home somehow. So, any other questions by the rack?
Swear words up on your screen here, Missy.
any questions by the public? Dan, Ken? All right. Let's talk about comments. We've got one comment card, and we don't have any more, right? Just the one?
Can I give you one? Am I allowed to do
that? No.
You
if you are, then I will.
That's it.
Ken Strong with SFW. Come up, state your name if you wouldn't mind, Ken.
I'm Ken Strong, fishing coordinator for Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. And Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife would like to thank each and every one of you for your efforts that you put in volunteering for Iraq and being able to improve the fishing and hunting in this great state of Utah. And Brett, personally, I would like to thank you for what you've done for the youth and for the birds.
Thank you.
One quick statement. The brook trout that he talked about that they wanted to put on no limit, I think that's very important that does go. There is a problem there with overproduction and there is a need to get some cutthroat so we can keep the federal government off our backs for not having enough. And on another quick issue, on Mammoth Creek, it is private property. There is 7 miles of the stretch, which is artificial flags and lures only at the present time. And the landowner is very concerned about the trespassing that's been going on. And it was mentioned that our law enforcement for the fishing game is spread far and few in between. And so he says that some of his fences are getting broke. So that's something that he would like, as he expressed in two racks, he would like to keep it the same as it is now. On UM Creek, before that, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife basically goes along with all of presented by the division, with the exception of the southern region and a couple of issues down there. One of them is UM Creek. We agree with the changes that the division says on cutthroat and trout with cutthroat markings being able to be harvested. We think that's a good idea, and we think it will help. But we also would like to see Mammoth Creek stay as flies and artificial lures only. There's approximately 20 miles of stream that goes, and then it goes into Mill Meadow Reservoir, and after that it becomes bait. On the East Fork of the Sevier, we would like to also increase the limit on the fish going from 2 to 4, as the division has proposed. But we want to keep, there's only 3 mile stretch there that is flies and artificial lures only. We would like to see that 3 mile stretch stay as flies and lures only. There's approximately 20 to 30 miles after that that's already open to bait. And when that was there was 16% of the statewide that opposed the deregulation of that in flies, but 51% of the anglers that fish that area wanted to keep it as flies and artificial lures only.
That's the East Fork?
That's the East Fork of the Sevier. There, if these are removed on these two streams, there will be no more streams in southern Utah that are set aside for flies and artificial lures only. They'll all be gone. So the fishermen and the people come in from all around the country to fish UM Creek and the East Fork of the Sevier. So we would like to see that remain artificial flies and lures, that 3 miles of East Sevier and the stretch of UM Creek. Those are the two. But we agree with the division's regulations of raising the limit and harvesting of the fish. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. All right. That was the only comment card we had, so we'll turn the time back to the RAC. Craig, tell me if we was to vote tonight to leave the Mammoth Creek as sounded like Ryan is proposing the last two two of the RACs anyway, two of the five RACs. I would like to see the trespass issue go away so that those anglers can go back and something work out, because I think it's commendable for the Hatch family for the last 15 years or for a long period of time anyway to allow trespass on their property. We don't see that often, I guess. I'd like to. What is I mean, if we vote tonight to do it for the trespass issue to go away and allow the anglers to come back, or
if the regulation, and I talked to our AG today, Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, if the regulation stands as is in the guidebook, we are responsible not only for trespass enforcement, but also for enforcement of a slot limit on a ground where the public is not afforded access. Which, in my mind, doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
Because we don't enforce fishing regulations anywhere else where public access is not afforded in the state.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what's the odds of the DWR and the Hatch family coming together and agreeing that, I mean, obviously the slot limit was put on there just to build the stream, I guess. That's the Hatch family wanted to build the fishery, and it sounds like maybe that's happened. I don't know.
I think that, you know, there's two sides of the Hatch family that kind of co-own the property, I guess. I discussed this with one of them last night, Ryan. Our conversation was cordial. I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to get something established here moving forward. And I, again, talked to the lieutenant, and we do need to strictly enforce trespass on that property. And when I say strictly, we're talking about revocation, and we're talking about multi-state reciprocity. To set an example to people to say that this is unacceptable. To simply fine people $100, again, is not going to curtail trespass, and it's going to be an ongoing issue, and it's only going to inflame the situation. I think if we set the example with some strict enforcement of trespass, continue to work with the Hatches to getting public access established, reestablished there, that it will be a positive thing moving forward.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanted to add one thing over there to Mr. SFW. Regardless of the outcome, I wanted to let you all know of any of the regulations related to the removal of fly and lure restrictions or special reg removals in the southern region this year. We will be working with SFW, Utah Angler Coalition, and others to establish opportunities on the landscape proportionally to what people are desiring according to what we're seeing in our angler surveys. That is something we have been remiss on in the past, and we've got to do a better job of that. And we've got bait anglers out there. We've got fly and lure anglers out there. We've got fly-only anglers out there. They each are their own unique thing. We need to carve out a piece of the landscape in the same way that the Forest Service does for them to have that experience isolated from other experiences, because they don't mix so well together. Just to let you know that that's what we're planning on doing.
If we was to consider something on Mammoth, that get rid of the slot limit, because that doesn't make sense to do that, but keep it flies and lures only, would that, do you think that would be a somewhat something that the Hatch family would like to see too? I mean, I the slot limit doesn't make sense.
The slot limit doesn't make sense from my perspective as a fisheries manager, but from an angler's standpoint and those that are actually utilizing that under special privilege right now, they view that slot limit and the regulation there as the reason why fishing is so great on that stretch of river. You know, we could go into all sorts of biological discussions as to why that probably isn't the case, but because there's no harvest anyway, so a slot is meaningless. But, I mean, I wouldn't, if you're going to maintain it as is. If you're going to remove it, it allows us to enforce trespass.
Right. Joe.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the trespass. Now, do these waters originate inside the property?
All but 6 feet of this creek is within the boundaries of the property.
All but 6 feet. So there is a 6-foot window where an angler can access the river.
Yes, there is a 6-foot window on one. It's not a window. It's an exit. It's a 6-foot segment just outside their property boundary near a bridge.
Wow. And how big is the creek? CFS. How much does it flow?
CFS, it's probably what would we call it? It's a moderate. I would say it's probably about wetted width of 15 feet.
35?
Yeah. 25, 35. Where did the southern rack, or the rack that's involved in this area, where'd they vote on this?
They were extremely supportive of maintaining it as is. Many of them indicated that they liked fishing there just fine.
But to fish there, they would have to get permission.
That is correct.
If you're a special what'd the rack end up voting to do?
Keep it as is.
How do you feel about the proposals the SFW made on keeping the flies and lures only? I don't see a
that's,
big downside to that.
That's kind of what I alluded to. We're completely comfortable with SFW's recommendations regarding maintaining some of the special regs down there, especially in light of the fact that it came out during the Southern Region RAC, which is why RACs are held, right? We had a discussion about how much in the way of fly and lure only water would be left in the Southern Region if these special regs were removed. And the answer was 0 miles. I did not know that going into this. We're more than comfortable with what SFW recommends. And as I mentioned, moving forward, we'd like to work with them and others to establish proportionally opportunities on the landscape based upon need out there.
I know there's a pretty good percentage of the, at least the fly fishermen, that are catch and release only, so. They don't do a lot of harvesting, at least.
Right. It and Ken and I have talked about this a little bit, just for a little clarification. During those types of negotiations, again, assuming that SFW's recommendations are supported, we would also like to begin the discussion about harvest. One of the reasons why, as I mentioned before, we put forward regulation recommendations, is to establish a certain level of harvest – so that we're able to cull populations to a degree that provides anglers with the resource that they want. They want large, healthy fish, not stunted, very abundant fish, in most instances. In instances where they want stunted and abundant fish, great, don't harvest any. But we do need to harvest fish on the landscape if we're actually going to keep things growing at rates that are desirable, achieving sizes that are desirable by anglers. So when we get into this discussion about setting up regulations, making sure that we're also discussing the need for harvest out there too.
Other questions by the rack or comments? I'll just leave my comment. I like the idea of leaving on UM Creek and East Fork and Mammoth, leaving them all flies and lures only. I like that idea. Kind of, I guess, torn a little bit over the slot limit on Mammoth Creek, but I do want the, Hatch family, it'd be nice if everybody get along. I guess we're at the point we can entertain a motion.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and make a motion that this RAC accepts the division's proposal as it's been presented here tonight, with the SFW's recommendations for leaving UM Creek in the East Fork of Sevier. The East Fork of Sevier Creek, artificial flies and lures only as well.
I second that motion.
Motion was made by Dan, seconded by Natasha. Discussion? All right, no amendments. We'll call for a vote. Those in favor? It's unanimous. All right, thank you, Craig. Appreciate it. Next on the agenda is the Deer Unit Management Plan. Riley, our Wildlife Central Region Program Manager.
While they're doing that, I move that Brad Horrocks buy us all breakfast for being late.
I offered to buy supper, and Boyd failed to do that tonight.
Well, it's all out there. We were just waiting for you to come cook it.
Let's adjourn for 20 minutes.
You know what? I'm only going to be about 10, so if you'll just give me 10 minutes of patience, then you can go.
Yeah, I'm putting you on my timer.
All right, go for it.
Actually, we all forgot about that, Brad. You're lucky, but we can do it for the next one.
Good. I'll furnish the crane.
So, my name is Riley Peck. I'm the Central Region Wildlife Program Manager. I'm here today to bring our mule deer management plans through. Mule deer management plans are revisited every 5 years. They're in conjunction with the range trend studies that take place all across the state. And our range trend studies for the Central Region units were just completed in 2017. And so we are following those up with an updated mule deer management plan. Mule deer management plans are kept within the sideboards of the statewide deer plan, and that is consistent with the plans that we are bringing forward tonight. There is nothing in these plans that are going against the statewide plan that has already been approved by the board. Here is just a general map of the units that we're talking about, specifically 16, 17, 18, and 19. There. One of the most popular questions on the unit plans are we changing or adapting or looking at something different with our population objectives? And we are not. We are not recommending a change for any of our population objectives on the unit management plan. Maybe second to population is our buck to doe ratios. Are we looking to change any of those? And we are not. We're looking to keep the buck to doe ratios the same, which do coincide with the proportions the statewide plan has put out. In all of our plans, we address agricultural damage and development mitigations. The central region is unique in that a very large portion of our region is right on that wildlife, urban wildlife interface. And so we deal a lot with developing communities, roads, highways, parks. The picture on the left was taken in the middle of Salt Lake County in Taylorsville. There was about a 4-acre water treatment, and so people were feeding them apples over the side. So we do have a lot of development issues as well as your normal nuisance and depredation, and so the plan does address for all of those.
What unit is that to put in for?
If you like the deer in the middle, then we have a slide to show that in just a minute. The Taylorsville unit.
Yeah.
We do, because of that, have a lot of opportunity to look at roadkill and predation and different diseases, and we have a lot of callers out now that we're trying to get at cause-specific mortality and understand what is specifically causing deer to die when they die. And all of those factors are addressed in the plan as well. One of the most important things that we have, and maybe the strongest emphasis on the plan, is our emphasis on habitat. We'll continue with the 5-year range trend study. We do spring range assessments, still continue on range rides, and look for improvements of different areas through our watershed restoration initiative. Here's a picture of that buck that I was telling you about. It's part of the urban deer management plan. We do have quite a bit of urban deer plans in our central region. And so one of the new aspects to this plan we are looking for is amending the statewide deer plan to include the south end of the Nebo unit as a deer translocation site. Right currently, we don't have a site within our region to take these deer. We are catching the vast majority of all urban deer in our region. We'd like to keep them in-house. This is less of a selfish thing and more of this. A lot of them are taking place during inclement weather, and it is sometimes tough to go 7 hours one way to drop a deer, or everything including disease, location, natural barriers, low deer population, excellent habitat, and so forth. By way of summary, we are not looking to change objectives, buck to doe ratios, or population. We want to continue a strong emphasis on habitat. We want to look at deer-specific issues, including damage both by encroachment and agriculture, and look at any cause-specific mortality we have. We are, like I mentioned before, asking for a new translocation site. And as I promised to be brief, that is all that I have for you guys.
Thank you, Rod. I guess I got a question. That one slide shot, it said buck to doe ratio was 25-25. Is that a typo?
Where buck to doe ratio?
Right there. Yeah, Vernon.
So the objective on the Vernon, it's not. So we don't have a range on the Vernon unit. And so just to keep it consistent, it is unique in that. So instead of putting 25 bucks per 100 doe, we just list, there isn't a range.
It's kind of like the other.
Just trying to manage for that. The Vernon is the limited entry unit that we have within the West Desert unit. So you'll notice on the slide before, we take a population objective and they are modeled together. But when we do our buck to doe ratios, we split it out. And the 3-year average right now is on 34, so we do have some room to add a few tags on that, but it is a pretty strict.
Okay. I just didn't know we had any that are just Siegel Deborah Woods.
No, you know, like the people on the Vernon have a strong desire to keep it pretty solid. They don't want any range. They really would like to nail us down, and it works for us. It's a good unit, and it's growing with quality.
Okay, thank you. Another question by the rack.
With all the construction going across Strawberry, and I guess it's probably a minute point, but the amount of deer that is killed across Strawberry, which I drive it once or twice a week,
so
most weeks.
We just barely met with UDOT, and there is a plan to fence it. So this brings some challenges from the top of Daniel Summit down to about where you turn off to go to the marina there is proposed to be fenced with construction and underpass for deer. Then there's going to be a gap in the meantime until you get to about the ladders. And for those that are familiar with that, from the ladders down around as we drop down towards Current Creek, that'll be fenced again. In the proposal, they will have the markers for sage grouse, since there are some sage grouse leks in the area. It is being gapped right now without the fence, and that's because there is not funding available for an overpass, and it is a pretty heavily used elk migration area, and they do not want to fence it until we can have more of a elk-friendly migration area. So the long-term plan is to completely fence it and have overpasses as well as underpasses. Until that funding is there, there's going to be a few mile gap in between. But the fence is planned for where most of the deer are killed, and the gaps are planned for where most of the elk migrate. So we've been working heavily with UDOT, and it looks good so far. We're excited about it.
Other questions, Brother Rack?
In a lot of that area, you're talking about fencing. When they ran livestock there, they would let the fence down in the winter because the snow would sit so heavy on that. Is that going to be part of the plan? That's a lot taller fence than a livestock fence.
It is a lot taller fence, and UDOT has in multiple, you know, this is a unique situation where it's such a high elevation fence, but that is addressed in it, and what type of fence can be put up when they take it out for bid.
Any other questions by the rack? Questions by the public? No questions? All right, I have absolutely no comment cards on this one. So bring it back to the rack for discussion and any discussion.
I think Ken has a comment.
I put that down on my comment card.
Oh, you did? I'm sorry. Ken Strong with SFW.
Really, it's nothing. Ken Strong, Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife, and we appreciate Riley and the effort he has made with his partners on this, and we stand behind him wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Any other discussion before I call for a vote or a motion? I'll call for a motion. Becca?
Oh, my goodness.
You had to know it was coming eventually.
You really want me to make the motion? Okay. I move to approve the deer unit management plan as proposed by the division.
That was Becca made that motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Oh, okay. We've got a second.
Double second.
Do we call for a vote? All in favor? And it's unanimous. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you.
Natasha was the second.
Natasha made second? I apologize. Natasha made that second. Did you get that? All right. Well, that's it. Well, those that have a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Brad made a motion to adjourn a second as Joe. I saw that head come up.
Yep.
All in favor? All right.